Hello and welcome to episode 211 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Hello everybody and welcome to episode 211 of WB40 podcast. And we have, well, an interesting show tonight because we were going to interview a guest, but owing to my lack of organisational ability, we've let them slip and now it's just Matt and I. So I think you'll find it's going to be one of those episodes that we probably look back on as a bit of a classic, but we just don't know it yet. Matt, how are you and how's your week been?
I'm very well. My week has been a combination of medical encounters, startling football results, and budgeting. Because it's that time of the year, we're into business planning at work, and so therefore I've been creating budgets, which is an amazing, amazing thing. We're trying to be able to create budgets that are for agile activity, iterative, sprint-based activity for the year ahead. And it's really quite hard because you kind of fall back into, well, we'll make it into a Gantt chart and then work backwards from that. And I'm trying not to because it feels like that is tantamount to setting myself up for a good hiding at some point in 22-23 when the pretend Gantt chart that I said was never a Gantt chart becomes, well, why haven't you delivered the Gantt chart? So I'm trying ways to be able to see if I can package things up in such that it gives me gives my finance director an understanding about how much money we are likely to be able to consume in the year ahead and what we might do with that money, but then also gives people some assurance that we are going to do something with it that makes sense from a business perspective, but also doesn't tie me into having to predict the future 18 months ahead, which quite frankly, I wouldn't be doing this job if I could do that. So yeah, it's been an interesting challenge.
It is always an interesting one, isn't it? Because one of the, well, agile is no panacea, we know that. But one of the things about agile is that you can at least say, we ain't going to overspend. Now, the problem with that is you are also saying, we ain't necessarily going to deliver everything we said we're going to deliver, but we will at least control the cost. We're not going to, you can control two things, right? You can control your cost or you can control your what you deliver. And you can't always guarantee the second, but you can say, well, we're not going to spend more than this. And you're going to say, well, and we'll deliver as much as we can for that. The thing about Agile, Agile Scrum and kind of the way that whole way of working and way of thinking is, the idea is that you should be able to show more quickly whether you're actually delivering value or not and make the necessary changes. You're not going to go down a cul-de-sac for so long, is the idea. The problem with a lot of our management approach is that we always assume that nobody's going to go down a cul-de-sac at all. And that's what the budget is based on. We're just going to do everything, it's all going to be fine, and there we go. And maybe a bit of contingency here and there for safety's sake. But it's not really based on how we know things work, especially in the way that we work now and the way that, the interconnectedness of everything and the amount of change that comes down the road just within a year. So first of all, you've got to get out of that mindset of, okay, well, we definitely know everything. It's this kind of conceit that we create a budget and then say, yeah, this is all definitely going to happen. And then you get to the point where you say, well, actually, I'm going to do a really good job this year, and I'm going to make sure that my people, and when they deliver something, deliver good stuff, right? And we are going to work hard, and we're going to work effectively, we're going to work efficiently, and my partners are going to work hard, and they're going to get be value for money. So the only thing that's really going to stop us is going to be those cul-de-sacs or, these U-turns, we built this thing and we made it green, but now we've got to go back and paint it blue. And those are the things that we really have to manage. And at that point, if you can control the first and say, actually, everything's going to be okay and we're all going to work hard and I've got the right people, I've got a talented team and all of that kind of thing, it really should only be the second that you end up worrying about. And it's that then you've got to concentrate on. Because, of course, it's often not that we've built something badly, it's just that we haven't had the right engagement. I mean, I was involved in an Agile project years ago, and I came in and joined the company halfway through it, and I was kind of told, just don't touch it, really, because we can't afford for it to go anywhere now. It's, we're halfway through, we're nearly finished. And I had a few worries about it, but I trusted that everybody, and I shouldn't have done that because there were some stakeholders that had basically bailed on it, and I hadn't noticed because I kind of thought, okay, fine, I've got other things I can be doing, I'll deal with that. a year later and dealing with fires from the fact that this particular set of stakeholders hadn't engaged and had bailed. Nobody really wanted to tell me either. So, yeah, I mean, Agile is a way to manage it, but it just shifts the problems and highlights the problems that might be elsewhere, gives you the chance to measure them and manage them, but you still got to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I'm getting to, a bit more context, is we've got a major procurement exercise happening over the next 18 months, which is for one of our biggest service providers. So not a technology-related thing, it's about people who provide major services for the organisation. But there's a lot of technology involved in that. So that works on quite a fixed waterfall timeframe-ish. But there's also quite a lot of regulatory constraint about what has to happen when, because of the level of spend and because of public sector procurement guidelines and because of consultation that we need to do with our customers and a bunch of things within that. So I've then got to be able to build in a capacity to be able to deliver as yet unknown technical changes into what is a kind of framework around it, which is a series of quite traditional waterfall-y kind of milestone-y kind of things. And I think what I've done so far, and what is probably going to be the way we'll do it, is rather than talking about what projects I'm going to run, I'm talking about how much capacity I can spin up. Because there's, you know, if we go through the list of all the things that we could do, we know there's more work that we can possibly do next year that we need to do at some point. So the demand for being able to do things is greater than our capacity to deliver. I can work out, because we've been going now for a couple of months with a sprint model, I know roughly now some models by which I can say how much a sprint will cost us in terms of people resource, what people are needed, and what money it costs. It might be the same every time, but at least we've got there for a number of sprints over the course of the year. And then the really interesting limiting factor is actually how much resource we will need from the organization itself. So not from within my team or from within technology partners, but how many people we need to lift out of the day-to-day work in the organization and get them to focus on change. And I reckon, finger in the air kind of stuff, but we probably need 2 full-time equivalents from the organization for each sprint to be active participants. And that might be 2 people, it might be 6 people, but a third, you know, can be divvied up either way. But I reckon that our organization probably can't, because we're quite small and we're quite lean, probably can't take more than 6 full-time equivalents out concurrently for a whole year. That's our absolute top load of how much we can do. So therefore I can work out, there's our cost per sprint. If we were to run at full capacity, and that's my budget, and I sort of reverse engineered it with a bit more of a waterfall-y approach as well, and actually they kind of marry up the numbers. So, but that idea about how do we provide a capacity for change, and that's how much that capacity will, even though all of it's CapEx, which then makes it a bit weird, because it's quite an operational model for thinking about how you deliver, you know, change and capital investment. But anyway, seems to be working so far. That'll be interesting to see how it pans out over the next few months as we go through the business planning work. The other thing, having been at last to have the minor operation that I needed to have a pain in my neck removed, which is now removed, it's all very good, and lovely service from the people at Kingston Hospital. It was all very personable, which has been one of my complaints about healthcare in the last few months with other experiences, which is all a bit cold and clinical, shall we say. A lovely chap who was doing the operating on me made me feel right at ease as he stuck knives into my neck. Very good of him. But my goodness, the paperwork that is involved. Every time I have some sort of intervention in the medical industry, in the reams and reams and reams of paper. What I've also noticed is they obviously have started to go through the first stage of digitalization, because they now stick barcodes on bits of paper. So you see these like great reels of barcode stickers to be stuck on documents. It's just nuts. But it's also one of those worlds where you think, I just wouldn't even know where to start.
I think that's the problem, isn't it? You can't just smash it all down and start again. So you have to do it very, very slowly. And that's what happens, you know, as you say, you're not really digitizing the information, but you're digitizing the fact that you've got the information probably with the barcodes, and then maybe where it's been, you know, because a lot of what goes on with hospitals and anywhere with paper records is finding the paper record so it's available to the right person at the right time. So yeah, I can see that. I know, absolutely, you know, having worked in hospitals in different parts of my career, they are paper jungles in that sense, and many institutions, you know, whether it be police or, you know, prisons or hospitals or any of those, a lot of those in schools, for goodness sake. I mean, I think of the changes that have been made in the last 2 years to the way we can teach, but, you know, school books are still very much the way things.
I think Google Classroom has had probably bigger reach in the last 12 months and is continuing to be used for homework setting. And actually that's been, I'd say that's a heck of a revolutionary change for the education industry because of some of those constraints about the size and the scale and the paper. But it's amazing to see how much of it reverts back to as it was before.
Yeah, and I think that's fair enough. I think something like homework can often be pushed to something digital because it's kind of, well, here's something that you're going to go and do a bit of reinforcement learning, and therefore it's probably not going to be assessed in any time, and it's not, you know, it's, you know, that it's never going to be 100% done. And probably once upon a time it was a worksheet that was photocopied 35 times and handed out to the class or whatever, and therefore it's kind of lends itself to going to being delivered digitally. I think and that, you know, given if you've got the capability to do it, and yes, you know, that's the whole point, isn't it? I think for a lot of organizations that's what's happened in the last 18 months, 2 years. They've been pushed and they've stretched their model and they've found different ways to do things, but those, you know, time-honored institutions are going to be, they're going to be paper-based for a long old time.
So anyway, how's your week been? What have you been up to in the last 7 days?
Gosh, well, it's a week of birthdays and whatnot in the Western household, because kids being twins, it's their birthday tomorrow. So daughter had a bit of a party at the weekend and doing, you know, all that kind of thing. So, and there are various other things that also happen around this time. So it's kind of all that's going on at home, and therefore I've been sort of either variously involved in or dodging that. And also I've been, you know, doing the healthcare thing, you know, visiting doctors and things with various family members and their ailments. So yes, all of that. And what else is going on? I mean, it's been busy. It's work's busy because it's that time of the year now. We're just sort of mopping up and new client, just one of new clients. That's good news. So going to get them on board in the next week. Or some clients who maybe have been a bit quiet because they've been finishing off heavy duty projects from the summer, starting to emerge, blinking into the sunlight. So we picked some of that up. Another one of my clients is leaving his job to go and do another job, been headhunted, which is great. And now, you know, so I'll be picking somebody else up there, and, you know, and it's all, you know, it's great fun. And we continue to do our thing. So yes, it's all good. I noticed the football, Matt, and I thought to myself, you know, you'd be pleased with that. But don't you get a bit tired of the patronising reporting? You know, yes, Watford beat Manchester United 4-1, but you wouldn't know it, would you? All you know is that Manchester United are in some sort of awful, hideous situation because they managed to lose to Watford, and that would wind me up as a if I, you know, it has in the past wind me up as a supporter of a team.
You kind of just get used to it after a while. I mean, the thing is, the Premier League is essentially a competition between 7 or 8 clubs with everybody else there to make up. I don't mind the match reporting so much. What really irks me is when you have previews of the matches where they don't even mention us at all. And that I find very annoying. But no, I mean, I think it's, as I was saying to a colleague this morning, that, you know, at the weekend when I went to the hospital, I was in and out again within 90 minutes, as was Anna Gerlach-Scholska. So very good, hey?
Yes.
Anyway, good. Right. So tonight, in a rapidly improvised show, we're calling upon the wonderful audience of the WB40 Signal Group, and we are entrusting our entire show to them. We've just about 10 minutes ago said we need questions because we're going to do another Ask WB40. And so we're going to go through those questions. We're going to take them in order, no matter what they are, how silly they are. The sillier they are, the more we are likely to be able to attribute them to the person who came up with them. So shall we see how we get on? Okay then, Ask WB40. It's going to be quite rapid fire because there's been quite a lot of questions. Thank you, dear listeners. Lisa is the first question. Why are you like this?
That's a very good question, isn't it? Because unfortunately, in order to answer that question accurately, we would have to understand what Lisa means by this. It's you know, it's really down to her subjective view of what we are. But I mean, I don't know whether I should be defensive or proud in answering this question, Matt. What do you think? I mean, we are a product of our many experiences.
Well,
I guess
we are. Well, we're a product of our inherited privilege plus experiences,
privilege.
Plus potentially some work involved along the way as well, plus a modicum of luck. So that's why we are like this. Next question, please.
Well, the next question was from Tom Geraghty, and he said, "Tell us about your boss."
Okay, my boss is interesting, actually. I think I might mention this on the show before, but for many years I've had the view that we should look to be able to bring together all of the service providing departments, internal service providing departments in an organisation. And where I am at the moment is the first time I've actually experienced that, where my boss is head of people and business services, which HR, learning and development, communications, facilities, health and safety, and technology and transformation. And Lucy comes from an HR background, and I think she's been there for about 4 years. And I mean, to be honest, we've had a couple of exec directors either leave or announce they're leaving recently. So at the moment, the main thing I tell you about her is she's far too busy because she's having to cover two roles rather than just one. What about your boss?
Well, I think in our team, boss is Martin, who's an Irishman who lives in Holland. So he's a Dutch speaker, but he hasn't shifted his Irish accent. So that's an interesting combination of dialects. But he's somebody who's been at the company for a long old time and knows it. You know, knows how to operate it very well. He's got all, you know, there aren't many operating instructions, but he's pretty good at it. So he's one of those people who you can rely on to if you've got a sticky question or a problem, he's generally got an answer, but other than that, he doesn't get in the way too much. So what more can you ask from a boss? As long as they don't get in the way.
Fabulous. Okay, next question is from Mark. With the collapse in the energy market, should IT departments be revisiting their supply with sustainability in mind?
Their supply? Is this a drugs thing?
Electricity, not drugs.
Oh, I see. Oh, in that case, well, I think IT departments assume that the lights are going to be on. I think there's a point at which you can't really do much more about it than that. I mean, other than I did once buy a generator for a company that I worked for because we did have one or two power outages, and we were the hub for a whole bunch of offices, and therefore, actually, if I could keep the servers on and the network equipment running, then at least everybody else could work. And also, I did once have to order an enormous generator to come and keep the business working, because we had the power off for over a day and something had to happen, and it cost a whole lot of money. And it was one of those decisions where I was a director of the company and there was nobody else around and I had to make a call. And it's one of those things where it actually cost quite a lot of money. We could get some, you know, we were insured. I knew we were insured. But I also knew that the excess on the insurance meant that if the power wasn't off for about 2 days after I'd got this thing in, then it wasn't worth it. And the power came back on after about like one day and 20 hours. So you know, it wasn't. You can't always get those situations right. But in terms of sustainability, I think it's a very difficult question to answer. What do you think?
I think one of the advantages of being in the organisation structure that I am at the moment, so I've got a lot more visibility about where electricity supply bills are, because one of my peers is the facilities management head, and we've got electricity for both our offices but also for elements of properties that we rent out as well. So there's a combination of stuff there. I think, yes, people should be looking at it, but actually at the moment with the cost increases that are going on, Your guess is as good as mine as to where it would be. Your story, though, about the generators reminded me of when I was working at Imagination, my predecessor, he was very proud of the fact that he created a system so the server room could be rigged up to an external generator, and all you needed to do was connect it to two enormous flight cases that he had built with, like, you know, those big things like the ones you stick into the side of cars, kind of electric cables in it. And all you'd need to do is to be able to get these two big flight cases away from the IT department and into the street in front of where the office was. And then you could drive up with a big generator and plug it all in, cables running through. Bob's your uncle. I didn't like to point out to him that they were stored in the basement, and the only way of getting them out was in the lift, which, if there was no power, might have been an issue. So, yeah, there we go. Anyway, next question.
Okay, so this one's from Tom Geraghty, another one from Tom, who asks us, what do you like about Boris Johnson?
I like the fact that he has got an unerring ability for when I believe that he can stoop no lower to prove me wrong.
Yes, I can't. I mean, I don't find many redeeming features in Boris Johnson, but I think the one thing I'd say that I like about him is that he is not dogmatic. You know, he hasn't got a, like an ideological belief in something that will push him to the point where he will do stupid things because he's got an ideological belief in them. He will do stupid things if he thinks that he can make some money out of them, or if he thinks it will get him out of a hole or whatever. But he can be pushed into slightly better positions on things like the environment because he feels that like there's a reason to be there. I mean, I'm grasping at straws, Matt. I'm running out of bonhomie.
Yeah, fair enough. Come on then, next question. Okay, what's the best thing about doing a podcast? That's from Lisa.
So, what's the best thing about doing a podcast? Well, the best thing about doing a podcast is, and I think we've said this a number of times, the best thing about doing a podcast, because there's only the best thing, is you get, it's just an excuse to have conversations about things that you probably wouldn't have otherwise.
That and the fame and the glory, obviously.
Well, there. And what have you learned about editing stuff, she says? And since that's, you know, pretty much exclusive.
What I've learned is it's way harder to do it in the old-fashioned ways than it is using the wonderful new Descript tool that I've been using for about a year, which enables you to edit using a transcript. So you're basically editing audio like you would a word processing document. And it's just revelatory in how much easier it makes it all.
Yeah, I edited the podcast a few weeks ago, if you remember, and I did it the old-fashioned way. And while I was doing it, I was thinking, oh, I bet Matt doesn't have to do any of this now. But he's completely sorted. So.
I know, it's amazing.
Yeah, I'd love to see how that works one day.
Next question, again from Lisa. What should people know if they're looking to set a podcast up?
Oh, they should know that there are a million podcasts out there with 3 episodes and no more, because people have run out of time and energy and enthusiasm, and they should know that they need a plan, probably either to do a season and have an idea, you know, we're going to do 6 podcasts and then we're going to have a bit of a rest and then we're going to do 6 more because we're going to have a think about it and we know what we're going to do, or to have some other way of keeping going, you know. If we were to start this again, I'd probably think about doing it in bite-sized chunks, whether it's 10 or 6 or whatever it is, to say, okay, that's how many we're going to do, and then we're going to step back and then think about it and do it again, which we kind of ended up doing because we would have a summer break, but yeah.
Yeah, we kind of overcommitted ourselves, really, didn't we? And we're now canon to it.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to do this forever.
There is no end.
What was the biggest waste of money?
Well, it's again from Lisa, and if in context of the podcast, I don't think we've really wasted any money anywhere along the line.
I don't think so. Did we? No, I don't think we invested in any online tools which were, you know, hideous. We've done some free trials of things which weren't much cop.
Yeah, no, it's been reasonably cost effective. The best investment, which she also asked in that same question, a lot of questions to Lisa, well done, is I think Descript is the best thing so far. It's the first piece of software in many years that I've gone, oh, that's magic. It is really quite something. Yep. So next one from Tom. What was the biggest production incident that you have in part been responsible for?
That's a really good question. I'm trying to think of the many catastrophes that I've been in part responsible for. I don't know. Can you think of any at the top of your head? Because I can think of a few, but I'm trying to think.
I've been lucky, I think, in that I haven't had any massive disasters. The one that immediately springs to mind, though, was not telling my colleague Simon not to use the vacuum cleaner in the server room at the BBC in about 1997, because it was looking a bit untidy and he was a bit of the sort of person who would go in and tidy it up. So he took the vacuum cleaner into the server room, plugged it in, and fused the whole lot, took the entire room down. And this was back in the day when, you know, offsite was not a thing. And it took us a while to recover from that. So don't be too tidy.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. It's very difficult for me because, there have been several things that I've done over the years that have taken the bit of the business down or whatever. Because once upon a time, you would be working, or certainly I would be working, on software in production in the business, because that's what it was then, right? This is years ago. This is just stuff you do. You know, you'd have software running and somebody would say, can we have one of these? And you'd write something, and you'd write a new screen or something, and you'd say, right, and then you can use it. And then the next thing you know, all the invoices for the last 3 months have had the wrong VAT on them or something, right? So these things do happen, but they happen so regularly.
I can't remember them all.
They're all gone by the by. So I can't really remember. But you know what? Back in those days, you would end up sitting on the floor of a computer room with bits of server all strewn around you as you tried to fix it, you know, in the middle of the night. And that was just part of the job. So I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Maybe if I sat down with a beer for an hour, I'd remember. But no, it's just that's just been part of my life. Right, Mark said, we talked about the energy market. He's still on about it. He asks what the UN's sustainable development goals will have on IT services over the coming years.
I think it's not going to be the sustainable development goals directly. I think it'll be whatever regulations by local governments to be able to enforce whatever environmental or sustainability agendas they decide they want to. Because basically, let's look at the way in which the technology industry works. If it ain't against the law,
yeah.
So they're not going to move on stuff. Everything will be severe greenwashing unless they're actually forced into being able to do things.
I think there are certain investors, and of course they're working mainly on an entirely selfish mode because that's what they do, but they're looking at this and they're asking companies to prove their sustainability credentials, that they're not going to run into any problems maybe in future with regard to what they do, so they know their investment is safer, right? So there are other mechanics at work, and I think some of the circular economy stuff and some of the way that the big manufacturers, the PC manufacturers and the server manufacturers work, I think is being affected by that. So, but are they because of the UN sustainability goals? I think more because I think they're part of the mix. So Lisa has asked another question. She's on fire with the questions tonight. What do you think businesses should know about the metaverse?
Okay, so metaverse at the moment is classic unknown problem, unknown solution. So you should know that everybody will be saying they're doing it and nobody will understand what it is because nobody's entirely clear because nobody really knows yet. However, the other thing, and this is an observation I made a few weeks ago, the metaverse has been around since the advent of branding. If you take the metaverse as being that we put the same or equivalent value into things that are imaginary, brands have been doing that for well over a century. So just because it's digital doesn't mean it's any different from Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola's brand value is bigger than Coca-Cola's asset value. It is the value of the Coca-Cola company. And that's metaverse as far as I'm concerned. What do you reckon?
Well, I think that metaverse, given that it's kind of all this AR, VR, you know, I'm probably a little bit more of a convert than I used to be, having experienced the tech that's out there now, there is something coming along these lines, but I think it's so early days. I don't know quite what it's going to look like. But what I would say is what businesses should know is that it's not going to be what everybody says it's going to be, right? When the internet came along and everybody said, all the commerce is going to be on the internet, people started designing online shopping malls, right? That's how it was going to be, where you'd be in this kind of online area where and of course it didn't turn out like that, but it was... It was designed that way because we thought it would be an electronic version of the world. And the metaverse, whatever it turned out to be, isn't going to be how it's conceived now. That's probably as much as I can say.
Fair enough. Another one from Lisa. She's on fire tonight. How powerful is your network?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So probably not as powerful as I think it is, but probably more powerful than I fear in my darkest moments. But I would say that how powerful is it? It's everything, really. And as I say to people, especially at the start of their careers, keep notes about who you talk to, make friends, be helpful. It's a sedimentary thing. It's not you can't make it quickly. Your network is something you build up over years, and you the value of it is directly proportional to how useful you are to it. So don't expect too much from it. Be useful to it, and then when you need it, it'll be there.
Mine's 48 meg down, 12 meg up.
Yeah, yeah. So Lisa continues and she asks, what should people do to stay curious and not become closed-minded old people, Matt?
Just because I'm marginally older than you. There was a conversation about this on the group this morning, and I don't know what it is, but if I look at my grandfather, who, my dad's dad, he stayed curious right until he basically lost his hearing and his eyesight. I think he was probably still curious of mine by then. And I don't know whether it's people lose their curiosity. I look around and I think, actually, there's an awful lot of people just don't appear to demonstrate any curiosity at all. So maybe it's not that you lose it when you get old. It's just that some people have got more of it than others. And if you've only got a little bit, then it'll maybe easier to disappear.
Yeah, I think we can all sometimes be a bit blindsided by change, and we're very busy doing what we do, and then we look up and everything's changed, and we think, oh, we're not going to engage with that, and then, you know, and guess what, it keeps changing. And I there's that, the old Bob Dylan lyric, isn't there? And I always, I'm not really a big Bob Dylan fan, but that whole thing about, you know,
Tambourine Man, that one.
Yeah. No, it's, the times are changing, you know, and the old road is rapidly aging, and you know, something like, if you get out of the new one, if you can't lend a hand, right? It's all of that, right? There's no point in saying, in bemoaning it, because you're just going to get run over if you do. So I guess be accepting. I've seen John Cleese on the internet recently talking about wokeness, and that to me is just the sign of, you know, there's a bloke who used to be it, and now he ain't it anymore, and he doesn't understand what's going on. So yeah, just accept that things will change, because if you don't, you're dead.
There might also be something about being able to understand and be able to articulate when you don't understand what's going on, which actually is something that very few people admit to in middle age, let alone in later life, because we're taught that we should know everything somehow. If the WB40 podcast had a soundtrack, what would it have on it?
Oh, it would be heavy, and it would be loud. That's what it would be. No, actually, do you know what? Funny enough, I was thinking about this on today. Well, I wasn't really thinking about this, but there was a point at which I was listening to the radio and there was a gap. And for some reason, I imagined the theme tune to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if you remember the radio series. I think it was the TV series. I think it was an Emerson, Lake and Palmer track, or there was some prog rock thing anyway. And I thought, oh, that'd be quite a good, like, what do they call it? Sting? Snippet? Jingle? Kind of thing for a podcast. But yeah, that's as much as I've thought of given to it. What do you think?
I think it would involve modular synthesizers self-generating, which is almost just like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, to be honest. But there we go. Where are we up to next? I'll do the next one. I won't do that. Right, from Robin. What are the top 10 best replies you've had on the Twitter? And what are the best troll points?
On the Twitter?
It's so ephemeral, isn't it? I mean, I barely can remember anything about it. It's like saying, what's the best conversation you've ever had in a pub? And it's like, well, I know I've had a good time having conversations in pubs, so I'm not sure I could stack rank them.
Exactly. That's right. My daughter was talking about Twitter the other day, because she's not really a Twitter. She's on the Instagrams and the TikToks and all that. And she says, oh, yeah, Twitter, you know, those posts get no likes, you know, virtually no likes. And I think, well, that's trying to say, oh, it's because they're really here to get a day gone tomorrow. They're very, as you say, ephemeral. And therefore, only recently, I'm trying to think. I mean, I've had the occasional sort of reply from people that, you know, you kind of admire. Or the only one I can remember is quite recently, and it was to do with Merv Hughes. You know Merv Hughes, don't you, Matt? So, and Big Merv, there was some video of him flogging Curtly Ambrose to the boundary in the late 80s, I suppose. And I saw it, and I just said, oh, you know, that was a rare Curtly Ambrose long hop. And he came back and told me off and said it was a searing bouncer that he managed to get on top of. And I was quite pleased about that, because, you know, he's a big comedy man, Merv, and it's nice to get a reply.
There is something nice about being able to sort of vaguely just not meet your heroes, but be somehow in touch with your heroes through social networks.
Well, I remember once upon a time replying to some tweet that from when astronaut that was on the space station, and they came and they tweeted back, and I'm just thinking, yeah, I've just got a tweet from somebody in space. That's got it. That's good, right?
That is. Really? So back to Lisa again. Our change freeze is a thing of the past.
Yes and no, right? In as much as there's millions of organisations which will have regular change freezes. There are millions of organisations coming up to Christmas when they'll put a change freeze in. And there are also in those organisations are millions of people going, we still do change freezes, but why aren't we doing things? Why aren't we running DevOps, and why aren't we, you know, deploying things all the time, and we don't need to worry about change freezes because we can, you know, we've got all the processes in place to manage change in a more iterative way and all that kind of thing. No, they're not. And yes, they will be, but no, not yet.
I think there's also, though, a bit of the reason why I make sure there's no change happening over the Christmas period of any substance is not because of the technology, it's because there's no non-technical people. So putting changes in at a time when there's nobody there, how are they going to adapt to the change? And it all come back and bite you on the arse the first day everybody's back after Christmas. So,
well, exactly. Well, if there's nobody there, there's nobody to do the change either, right?
Well, there is that as well, yeah. So, Next.
Well, I mean, she does ask what steps you can take to make your dev processes more robust, right? So, which is a really open question. But if you don't mind, Matt, I'm just going to, because we talked about, I don't know, did we talk about this on mic or were we talking about it beforehand?
Yeah, we talked about it.
One thing I did once, I talked to some developers about this as well, about to say, look, figure out what it is that makes your projects go wrong. And actually, that stakeholder thing is really important, right? So monitor that and say, right, if you don't turn up to meetings, that's a red light. And if we have so many of those red lights, we're just going to fail, right? The project is much more likely to fail. So measure the things that matter. And those things are very rarely lines of code or lines, you know, or velocities and all of that kind of thing, which is interesting, but it's not. It's that stuff. Sorry. What do you think? What do you think, Matt?
I honestly don't. I think that the thing I would come back to, though, is that actually processes around development aren't about development. They're about processes of how people work to each other, so work with each other. So it's all about all the stuff that Tom Garrity talks about around psychological safety and all that jazz. It's all the stuff that people who are generally involved in the development world often don't take much notice of. So there you go. Next one. If you could pick your dream board, who would be on it? What makes a high-functioning exec committee rather than a functioning sociopath, rather than high-functioning sociopaths?
Oh, well, that's a really good question, isn't it? And I don't know about people, right? Because I've worked with some perfectly good people and I've worked with some absolute rotters, and I'm not really into the kind of core personality thing. I can't think of people, famous people, that I'd really want that. Because everybody's got their pros and cons, right? There are some very, very talented people. You might think somebody like Douglas Adams, right? Say, oh, wouldn't it be great to have Douglas Adams on the board? But yeah, okay. Or Richard Feynman, or these sort of people. Brilliant people not sure I'd always work with them that well. I want some people on the board who would do as I told. That's essentially what I need. I don't know how to answer that question, because you just want people who know their business, who stay within their lines and don't you know, help, but don't get into the politics and spoil it for everybody.
The book I'm reading at the moment, I think, called Humankind, and the book generally is about how humans are generally pretty good, and the idea that we will fall apart and the entire civilization will fall apart at the drop of a hat is actually nonsense. And the pandemic has shown that, actually, is another example of it. But we're on to the chapter now. I'm on to the chapter now where it talks about what happens for leaders and why do we appear to be led by people who are, to use a colloquialism, assholes? And from what I've read so far, I mean, there's definitely the old thing about sociopaths and narcissists and Machiavellians rising to the top because they're sociopathic Machiavellian narcissists, but it seems there's quite a lot of evidence that people once put into a position of power become a bit of an arse. So people who can resist the becoming an arse tendency would be good. And I think the other bit from that is also people who listen more than they talk. Anyway, next question from Sharon. Tell me your greatest work fuck up.
All right, well, I think I've said this before, but probably for me was realizing that I was in a company that couldn't possibly work because there were so many things, and there were people being drafted in who were just rubbish and bullies and were not going to be good for me or the business, and staying around just to fight them because I found them so objectionable rather than just going. Why did I do that?
Yeah, mine was probably going to work for Microsoft, not because Microsoft is inherently a bad place, but it's just I was never going to fit there, and yeah, but I learned loads, so you kind of, you know, it's not all terrible. I know how to negotiate with software companies when it comes to licensing agreements now, because I understand how it works on the other side, so you know, that's all positive. Next.
So let's see what's going on. So I'm going to scroll down. That's not a question. Okay, so here's from Mark again. Why are so many people in IT focused on development when there are so many IT careers that don't involve writing code?
It's the cult of the inventor, I think, which is a term I've just made up. But if you think about the way in which history is told about the people who create new things, not about the people who maintain the existing. But the people who maintain the existing are obviously more important in the way in which history functions. But there's no interesting narrative around it. Yesterday I went and tended the machine. Today I went to tend the machine. Tomorrow I'm going to tend the machine, as opposed to, eureka. So I think that's probably the main thing. It's because the stories aren't as good. Something about the human psyche of storytelling wants to know about the novel.
Yeah, makes sense. So we're going to come back to Lisa for the last one, maybe, Matt.
Okay.
So Lisa asks, what's the best biscuit?
Depends what mood I'm in, you know. I think that there's a breadth of biscuit options, and it's not necessarily the right one at any given time. Actually, no, I'll tell you what I will go for. I'm going to be controversial here, and I'm going to say it's Carl's large table water biscuit with a nice bit of cheddar and some pickle.
Yeah, I don't think that's in the spirit of the question.
No, honestly. But it's my favourite biscuit. I prefer it to sweet biscuits every time.
Yeah, that's not the question, though, is it? That's not the question. Isn't what your favourite biscuit is, Matt. The question is, what is the best biscuit?
Well, that is the best biscuit. Table water table biscuit from Carr's, made in the northwest. Didn't produce them for nearly a year after they had the bad flooding up there. It was a terrible time. Barely survived.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I didn't eat a biscuit for like 3 or 4 years, barely ate a biscuit. I'd convinced myself that I was a person that no longer ate biscuits, and therefore I was, and I'm sure I did. I was all the better for it. And then suddenly, in the last, I don't know, 6 weeks, I think I've eaten about 300 weight of biscuits because they happen to be in the house, and I've just broken the seal on eating biscuits. I would say that I am a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to biscuits, really, and a malted milk is a fine biscuit that needs serious respect. Rich tea is actually a superb biscuit that is often neglected in terms of its quality. And a digestive, I mean, maybe just a humble digestive is the best biscuit. I'm partial to digestive.
Well, I have to extend a huge, we have to extend a huge, whatever it is you extend, of gratitude to the Signal Group for being able to create what hopefully has been an entertaining and interesting episode of WB40, or Ask WB40, as it is obviously known. It's good to know, I think. I mean, to the question of that thing about how strong is your network, which obviously I was completely flippant about, for which I apologise, but we can put something out, and literally that the whole show was constructed almost real time. Isn't that amazing?
Amazing, Matt. I mean, some people might say that we could just toss this out and that's the level that we're at, but I say that that shows the quality of the people that we're working with.
Absolutely. Quality of the listeners. That's you. Thank you. So we look ahead to the week ahead, 7 days from now. What's on your diary?
Well, there's a good question. So as I said before, we've got the sort of birthdays going on. So that's happening in the house. And it's also Mrs. Weston and our wedding anniversary and 19th wedding anniversary tomorrow. So I might even be able to get out for a spot of lunch and a little tiny celebration with Mrs. Weston. And other than that, that's pretty much all I can think of, to be honest. It's just, that's one lot. What about you?
The week ahead consists of, I'm running a session with my cards for a business management group in a law firm, which is going to be interesting. I'm going into London to do that on Wednesday first thing. I've got 19 packs of the cards in prototype form, physical cards out now with people across not only the country, but from as far east as the Czech Republic and all the way over to Seattle on the West Coast, which is what I say, in Seattle in the West Coast. Obviously, I posted them 2 days ago, so they're probably in Heathrow.
International cards.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You should have sent them with Steve Robson. He could have taken them for you.
Ah, oh, that's a point, but, you know, there we go. So that's very exciting to see if I start to get some feedback from there. It's going to be really miserable if nobody says anything about them at all, but I'll, you know, not let that get to me too much. And Wednesday evening is the first advisory board for Creative Dance London, which is the charity that I am advisor to the board of, amongst other people. So that's going to be really interesting because it's an area that I know little or nothing about in terms of the actual medium of dance. But it's a really interesting charity that does work with elderly groups and other groups in London and around London to be able to get them moving, which feels like it's probably a very good thing. So that's Wednesday. And then, it's birthday weekends in our household as well. So there's some people coming over for dinner on Saturday. And it's going to be a busy... Actually, I'm going out for a friend's birthday on Friday night as well. I'm going to be wrecked by the end of it. That's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be a hollow shell of myself with a gash on the back of my neck from where I was operating.
At your age.
But I know. Shocking, isn't it? So we will be back next week. We may or may not have a guest. We'll see how it goes. Thank you very much for listening. And we will see you next week back here on WB40. Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at wb40podcast. And you can join our Signal group if you send us a private message. Private message, not a dirty message. Thank you. And that's it. And just listen to us and subscribe on any good podcasting platform.